Jonathan Edward Harry is a British writer and journalist who wrote columns for The Independent, the British newspaper, and Huffington Post. And he wrote the following. In the early part of the last century, an experiment was done to determine if addiction to harmful substances was inevitable given the right environmental conditions. They put a rat in a cage and gave it two water bottles. One contained just water, and the other one was laced with cocaine or heroin. In doing that, the rats almost always preferred the drugged water, and almost always killed themselves very quickly within a few weeks. So the theory of addiction is simply that we prefer pleasure over self-preservation. Immediate gratification takes precedence over long-term good. Canadian psychologist Bruce Alexander came along in the 70s and said, "Wait a minute, we're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do. It's bored. Let's try this a little differently." So Bruce built what was known as Rat Park. And Rat Park is like heaven for rats. Everything your typical rat could want, it's got in Rat Park. It's got lovely food, lots of friendly rats to play with. It's got colored balls, plenty of distractions. And they've got both water bottles. They've got the drugged water and the normal water. But here's the fascinating thing. In that environment, in Rat Park, they don't like the drugged water. They hardly use any of it. None of them ever overdose. None of them ever use in a way that looks like compulsion or addiction. What Bruce says shows that both the right-wing and the left-wing theories of addiction are wrong. The right-wing theory states that it's a moral failing. You're a hedonist. You party too hard. You have no self-control, and it's simply a bad choice that you make. The left-wing theory is that drugs just take you over. You're helpless. Your brain is hijacked. It's not your fault. You can't help yourself. It's not a choice. It's a condition. Bruce says it's not your morality and it's not your brain. It's your environment. It's your cage. Addiction is largely an adaptation to our environment. We've created a society where significant numbers of fellow citizens cannot bear to be present in their lives as they are without being drugged. We've created a hyper-consumerist, hyper-individualist, isolated world that is, for a lot of people, much more like the first cage than it is like the bonded, connected cages that we need. So he says the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And our whole society, the engine of our society, is geared towards making us connected to things and not people. You're not a good consumer capitalist if you are spending your time bonding with people rather than buying stuff. He says, in fact, we've trained people from a very young age to focus our hopes and dreams and ambitions on things we can buy and consume. And drug addiction is really a subset of that, or a result of that. Now, personally, I think this is a bit of an oversimplification about the cause of addiction. Other studies conclude that some people are more genetically inclined towards addictive behaviors, and addicts of one type or another have probably always been with the human family. We've always had some who are addicted to certain foods or inclined towards addictive behaviors, and addicts have always been around. I'm sure as soon as, I believe it was in Egypt, fermentation was discovered and beer was developed, I'm sure there were some who struggled to not overindulge. But I would completely agree with the theory that in today's consumerist culture, we have so often replaced connections to people with connections to things. And in many cases, it's an empty connection that draws those people to being addictively stimulated and elevated out of their seemingly dreary existence. And to whatever degree it is scientific, there's no doubt that healthy mental and spiritual development includes strong connections with others. In fact, I would say that we're designed and created to need relational connections, even for those who may think of themselves as loners or introverts. Not necessarily vast numbers of connections. You don't need to be a social butterfly to be healthy, but meaningful and deep connections to our Creator and to each other. And I think that's what the Bible story is all about. But to see that, from the beginning to the end, we must understand what sort of literature Genesis is. If we start off wrong in Genesis, nothing else properly makes sense. Stephen Katz is the founding director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University in Massachusetts. He knows a thing or two about the Hebrew mindset and the Hebrew language. Responding to the fundamentalist Christian and fundamentalist Jewish views that Genesis informs us about a 6,000-year-old earth, Katz says, quote, "In Jewish religious thought, Genesis is not regarded as meant for a literal reading, and Jewish tradition has not usually read it so." End of quote. The Genesis story of Adam and Eve is not a historical account of the first humans. It is primarily a spiritual lesson that instructs us about connection and relationships between God and man and human to human. And it's a cautionary tale about the real and tragic results of what happens when those critical relationships are broken. Think Sodom and Gomorrah. Think Noah's flood, all of these stories, even Cain and Abel. It's about relationships that become broken, and then all hell breaks loose. And much of the rest of the Bible is about how to restore these relationships and return to a state of, you could say, Eden, or you could call it the kingdom of heaven. It's the same concept. We diminish the story in Genesis when we think of it as an actual first day of a literal seven-day creation. First of all, there are two different creation stories in Genesis that contradict each other, written by two different authors at two different times for two different reasons, similar but irreconcilably different, and there's no need to try to bend them to fit. Genesis 1 starts with the earth inundated with water, Genesis 1 verse 2. That's it. The earth covered in water. And then God has to separate the water for dry land to emerge, Genesis 1 9. Genesis 2 begins with the earth as a dry wilderness in Genesis 2 5, until a stream or mist emerges to provide water. In Genesis 2, verse 6. Genesis 1 has water first and then land, followed by plants, animals, and finally humans, consisting of both male and female at the same time. By contrast, Genesis 2 begins with the existence of land, and then comes water, followed by one human, Adam, then plants, animals, and finally a woman taken from the rib of Adam. When Genesis was assembled into the first book of the Torah, the fact of these contradictions was well known, and their dual inclusion was not an oversight or a mistake. They were both intentionally placed side by side to reinforce a powerfully inspiring, insightful message, and that is whether God is distant and transcendent, as in Genesis 1, where God is outside of creation speaking the universe into existence, or whether he is close, intimate, and involved, as in Genesis 2, where he's walking and talking in the early morning mist of the garden, taking a rib bone personally and forming a woman out of it. Either way, God made us for a purpose, God knows us intimately, and God is big enough and able to care about what happens to us here on earth. And the mesh that holds his highest creation, humankind, together with him is an active, communicative, and ever-growing relationship until we break that. And what both accounts forcefully agree on is that God made human beings to need each other and to need him in order for the human-to-human relationship to be complete and healthy. I want to tell you about Anna Sawarski because loneliness is an epidemic in our world. And it doesn't always lead people to addiction, but it leads to dysfunction of one sort or another. We tend to leave lonely people alone, don't we? We often have the view that person probably prefers their own company, and I won't bother them. If they want something, if they need anything, I'm a good Christian, I would help them out, but they clearly want to be left alone. In the case of Anna Sawarski, she lived alone and rarely had contact with others because she had emigrated from Ukraine and never fully learned to speak English. She wasn't really a loner. She was a reserved, single, senior woman who had major communication challenges. I met Mrs. Sawarski when I was 24 and just starting my three-month ministerial training program in Saskatoon in the summer of 1984. The Saskatoon pastor at the time, also Ukrainian, Morris Yurku, and I, he had planned for us together to spend the summer visiting all of the Saskatoon members. And we were going to visit them one at a time, and we did that, but we finished within the first few weeks. So I was let loose for the rest of the summer to mostly visit whomever and whenever I wanted. The problem was, most people weren't home during the day. So my short list of victims who had to sit and chat with this fresh-faced, slightly English-sounding 24-year-old with relatively little life experience was pretty much limited to seniors. Sorry. At my first visit with Mrs. Sawarski, I got the impression that she was not very friendly. And she was a cat lady. And I did not like cats. I do now, just for you cat lovers. I love cats. Cats are great. But at the time, my only previous experience with cats were Scottish farm cats that like to jump up on your lap and dig their claws into your leg and bite and scratch. Her house was a cluttered hoarder's disaster, and piles of books and boxes had to be moved out of the way so that we could even sit down and talk. There were more plants on the inside of the house than on the outside. And when she offered us some tea, I rudely but politely refused because I was uncomfortable with the chaos and the cat fur. And it just didn't seem very sanitary. So to be honest, I went back for a solo visit a few weeks later, not because I wanted to try to carry on another painful conversation with this woman or to meet her cats again, but because I had to fill my visit quota and she happened to be home. But over that summer, I visited Mrs. Sawarski many times, and she became one of my favorites to visit. As soon as I got out of my own need to be comfortable or to check names off my visit list and think about her interests, I found that she had an incredible life story. She had a very sharp mind, that knew far more on many subjects than I knew, and just her journey and her reason for coming to Canada from Ukraine was fascinating. She, like many, if not most, older generation Ukrainians, was a fantastic gardener. And instead of squirming around her shedding cats, I asked about her childhood, and we'd go for a walk outside to her back garden, and she showed me all her plants, and she had what you could only describe as a green thumb. Her garden was incredible. And as the weeks went by, this seemingly grumpy, disheveled, disinterested old woman came alive as we conversed in her very broken English, and she even started to smile when I showed up at the door. She wasn't unfriendly, she wasn't cold, she was isolated and just needed people to put in a bit of effort to care about her, not as a name on a visit list, but as a person with a unique and rich life history. Addiction in its many forms is a potential outcome of human isolation, boredom, and disconnection from relationships. And sometimes the root cause is selfishness. Sometimes it is just laziness or even sociopathy. But these are far from the only reasons for broken and lonely people. And yes, lonely people should try to move to those uncomfortable places where they make room for others and put some effort in. But so too should we, those who are able to help those who are struggling, help them with relationships. Of course, unless it's because of antisocial behavior or because of destructive behavior, but there is a great deal of responsibility on us to gently encourage lonely people, isolated people, back into healthy connections. And I just want to close with this from one of the letters of Paul to the church in Philippi, in Philippians 2, verses 1 to 4. He says, if there are any encouragements from belonging to Christ. I love how he sets that up. He says, you're Christians. You claim to be Christians. You have an idea of what a Christian is in a very loose and a very general sense. This is long before any church creeds and conferences had taken place where they defined specifically what heaven was, who Jesus was, and all that stuff. He's saying, look, you believe that God has done something to you because of Christ that has changed your life forever. And if that is the case, then that's not the end of the relationship. It doesn't stop with you getting something. He says, if there's any encouragement to you personally from belonging to Christ, if it's made any positive difference in your life, any comfort from his love, if you've had any fellowship together in the Spirit, are your hearts tender and compassionate? Then make me truly happy. And he's writing this not as scripture. He's not intending this to become part of the Bible someday. This is a pastor writing to the people he had visited and baptized in Philippi. He said, would you do me a favor? Would you do this one thing for me? If you have benefited from being part of this Christian community, then make me truly happy by agreeing wholeheartedly with each other, loving one another, working together with one mind and purpose. Don't be selfish. Don't try to impress others. Be humble, thinking of others as better at times even than yourself. And I'll close with this last sentence, and this is the essence of my message today. It's so simple and profound, and it's so rare. It's so rare for people in our culture, in our society, that are so into themselves and into their selfie pictures and promoting me on social media. He simply says, don't look out only for your own interests, but take an interest in others too. Couldn't be simpler, and yet it's so very rare and so very difficult for so many to do.